The philosophy behind the doctrine of discovery and early colonial entitlement and oppression of other cultures is not something that has gone away with the so-called advancements of our society. Though we've come a long way, the elements of racism, Eurocentrism, and outright dominance of other cultures surfaces today in other ways. Take a look at our public schools. When a whitewashed version of the Columbus story is still being taught, what does that say about modern society, and how does that affect our psyche and interaction with others? Bill Bigelow is author of Rethinking Columbus. He is an educator and editor of the widely read publication Rethinking Schools. He adds this.
Well, I think it is problematic. I think that, Columbus has been a lot of things to a lot of people. And the reason why Columbus first was embraced in the United States was because he was a founder, he was a hero who wasn't British. And so it's when King's College becomes Columbia. And it's when Columbus begins to be celebrated in the United States. And then, of course, at the end of the 19th century, he becomes something else. He's an imperial hero. And, hey, here's a guy who struck out from one country and went and took over other places, and wasn't that a great thing? And so he was explicitly useful as an imperial hero. And he was also useful for Italians who were being discriminated against, and the Klan was going after Italians. And so Italians were able to grab a hold of Columbus and say, look, wait a second, he was an Italian, and he was a great American hero. And so, and we're Americans too. And so Columbus has been a lot of things to a lot of people. Unfortunately, the impact that it has on kids is to celebrate imperialism and to celebrate the taking over of one people by another. And you can just see it still in almost every children's book. It's almost as if it were written by the same guy, And so Columbus comes over and he plants the flag and he claims the land in the name of the king and queen, and he renames it San Salvador. And isn't this wonderful? And kids are never encouraged to ask the most basic question of all, which was, well, why do you have a right to do that? How did he get to, weren't there people living there? Yes, there were. Didn't the land already have a name? Yes, it was called Wanahani by the Lucayans who lived in what's now the Bahamas. So kids are what's silenced, and it's the beginning of this kind of silencing of important perspectives in the curriculum, where kids are not taught to think of some people as having rights. Noam Chomsky talks about the way in which the newspapers teach that there are two kinds of people in the world. They're the owners and they're the unpeople. Well, the curriculum does the same thing. It establishes, and Columbus is a great example, there are the people, the real people, the full people, the owners, and then they're the unpeople, the people we don't have to pay attention to. And that's the problem with the Columbus story, is that it teaches kids that it's okay to take over other people and rule them, that it's okay for some people to boss other people. It's teaching about whose lives matter. And if some people are focused on and other people are marginalized, then it's screaming at kids, some people mean more than other kids. And so if Native kids or African-American kids or Latino kids are not seeing themselves reflected in the curriculum, and it's like a mirror. And if you're not seeing yourself, you're like, you feel invisible. I mean, just imagine the kind of anger and that generates. And I think you speak really eloquently about that. Well, but it's contradictory. It's true that there's a lot of biased material in the curriculum, but it's also true there's a lot of language about being balanced and being multicultural, and so I think that teachers have a lot of opening to teach a more critical curriculum. One of the things that I do is I just start out and I ask my students, hey, how many of you have ever heard of that guy, who they say he discovered America? Who is that guy? And all the students will say Columbus. And then I say, yeah. And who was it who he met here? And a number of kids will say, well, the Indians. And I'll say, yeah, not just the Indians. But what nationality? What specific group of Indians? And in 30 years of teaching, I've never had a single student be able to say the Tainos. And so I'll tell kids, I say, well, you know, so there were millions of these Tainos. So isn't it interesting that we all know the name of this guy Columbus, but not a single one of us, not a single one, knows the name of the people who were here first? Wow, what does that tell us? And so from that standpoint, you're able to alert kids to the fact that they've only heard one side of the story. And so you know, kids have a basic fairness. They have a basic sense of we need to have balance. We can't just hear one side of the story. And so it opens them up to looking more critically at a fuller story.
Bill Bigelow has taught social studies at Franklin High School in Portland, Oregon, and has been fortunate enough to have some of the freedom necessary to take new and creative approaches on subjects such as Columbus. Garen Salazar was a teacher in the poor district of Watts at Jordan High School, where there is a deep history of repression and where the community remains in a constant state of harassment and grief, a police state. Community members and police and local politicians clash in what is, in my opinion, a modern day version of a colonial community. Here's her story.
Well, I was teaching at Jordan High School English. I was there for 2 years, and from the beginning, you know, I could tell that I was going to have trouble with the administration. My first year of teaching, there was a group of students who began organizing themselves. They called themselves the Watts Student Union. And how they really kind of came about was, you know, just a group of just your average high school students, you know, in Watts, you know, began to look around them and really, you know, saying, hey, you know, we know that things aren't supposed to be this way, but we want to be proactive about it. And so what they did was identify issues or problems that they saw in their school, in the community, and took it a step further and identified solutions for those problems, like the ways, things that the school could do to concretely improve the everyday lives of students. And so they presented them as a list of demands, 26 demands. They presented it to the school, they presented it to the district, and they felt that the students were trying to embarrass them. You know, they were, you know, the students were calling them out, and so they took it as an attack rather than students, you know, really practicing self-determination. And so they tried to go after the students. When the students were not easily intimidated, they began to go after faculty. So there was another colleague, Mark Gonzalez, and I, you know, we did work closely with the students. We supported them in what they did. So Mark and I were in the same academy or small learning community. They separated us. They put Mark in a ninth grade classroom with a scripted curriculum. And then the school year ended, this school year started, and the attacks kind of started on me. So I was getting observed very frequently in my classroom. It's average that a teacher is observed anywhere between 1 and 3 times in a given school year. I was observed about 17 times. So it's over 5 times what's the average. And so when I was getting observed, I was getting these kind of crazy evaluations. Like, for example, there was one assignment where students were doing a cross-textual analysis of the Gina Six case with the Emmett Till case, and they were presenting their analyses in the forms of sonnets. And so the assistant principal that came and observed my class said that I was creating militancy within students, and his write-up was about militant students. It had nothing to do with, are students learning to read and write better? Are they analyzing? Are they thinking critically? He just said that I was making them militant. And so that kind of thing kind of kept going on. Things began escalating in, I want to say, early April. Again, the same assistant principal came, observed my class. My students were reading a 3-page excerpt of the autobiography of Malcolm X, which is an LAUSD-approved text. It's a text used widely, you know, throughout the country and other nations as well. My students were analyzing it, providing textual evidence for their analyses, you know, doing very high-level thinking. And what the assistant principal wrote in his evaluation of that lesson was that I was brainwashing students and forcing extremist views on them. And so so immediately, you know, I knew that I couldn't just let that be on paper without me challenging it. So I immediately challenged it. You know, I got you know, other people involved at that point. And 2 weeks later was when I was informed that my contract wouldn't be renewed. Because I'm an untenured teacher, a non-renewal of contract basically means that I'm fired, not only from the school, but from the entire district. So that happened in late April. You know, students began to organize themselves, community members. I'm a member of the Association of Raza Educators, or ADE. So ADE immediately began organizing as well, supporting students and parents in their efforts. And so there was, you know, there's a lot of kind of retaliation from the administration that happened as well, both on the students' parts. You know, a lot of them were being threatened with suspension or just being pulled out of class and being harassed, you know, being told that they wouldn't be able to participate in senior year activities if they continued, those kinds of things. On the teacher end, you know, I was being told that I was, you know, putting, like, death threats on the principal, or getting, you know, one of the gangs or whatever, one of the crews in the area to put out a death threat on the principal. So things, you know, really escalated. In the end, all the pressure, the community pressure, the student pressure, led to the superintendent of the school district finally stepping in and acknowledging that the principal had basically targeted me and had attacked me. And so he reinstated me in the district, but also reemphasized that I could not return to Jordan High School, which was the ultimate goal. I guess in the end it didn't even really matter, though, because I was blacklisted from the district. Principals told me straight out, no one's going to hire this either. No one wants to be the school to hire you after what happened there. And so I wasn't able to get hired in the district right now. Just earlier this month, I got hired at a charter school, so that's kind of where I'm at now. We're exploring legal options right now, but unfortunately there's a really bad precedent that was set with another case similar to my case, also in Watts at the neighboring Locke High School. A teacher there was fired, also untenured, for not allowing school security and school cops to come inside her classroom and search students. And so her case, she originally won it. It was then overturned. And so that overturning kind of set a really bad legal precedent. So right now, you know, I've got a lawyer, you know, kind of looking into things and seeing if there's, you know, other legal options that we can explore. But that's, in a nutshell, I guess, kind of what happened.
Karen elaborates further on why she feels that the administration at Jordan felt so threatened.
I think first and foremost it had to do with the students who were already organizing. And I think that what I was teaching students, what my curriculum was based on, is really a critical examination of why things are the way they are, how they got to be that way, understanding that it's not an accident, it's not coincidental. It's not natural, it's not normal. And so when students begin to understand why things are the way they are, they understand that it's been created that way, and if it can be created, it can be destroyed. So automatically leads to people taking action. And so I think that that's really what they're afraid of, is that when you have this type of curriculum, students are going to act. You know, they're going to understand, you know, we always, you know, say this, you know, it's to know yourself is to love yourself. And if you love yourself, you're going to defend yourself. And so that's, you know, kind of the natural course of action that the students are beginning to take. And it's what the administration was afraid of.
Joseph Quiñones is an educator and longtime activist. He was at one time a very active member of AIM, the American Indian movement that was very visible during the civil rights movement of the 60s. He speaks on his experience with miseducation on the Reds.
Yeah, one of the things that I was able to do several years ago, they invited me out to the Fort Hall Indian Reservation because they heard of me somehow, and they said, we want you to come out and take a look at our school system out here, because they had an 80% dropout rate in the high school of Indian kids. It was an Indian school on Indian reservation, and they had an 80% dropout rate. They were just not getting their degrees. And they wanted me to tell them what the reason was. You know, they wanted me to come out and look at that, which is pretty interesting. I was still active with AIM at that point, and I don't know how they called on me. Anyway, they got me out there. So I went out, and at the same time, they had asked this guy who was with a native, he was native, and he was I forget his name, he was a PhD in education, and he was Native, and he'd come out of Phoenix, and he was the University of Phoenix, and we both showed up because they had both of us kind of looking at it, but we didn't work together. But see, my approach was to go in and look around and see, like, who was working there. So there were no Indian teachers there were no Indian administrators. The Indian people working there were, guess what, the janitors, the guys who did the yard work, and the people who cooked and cleaned up. That's the only Indian people they had working there. This is on an Indian reservation. So the principal, the vice principal, all the teachers, everybody was white. The school board on the Indian reservation, not a single Indian person on the school board. Okay. I went and started looking at the curriculum. I walked in the library and started walking around looking at the books. I found one book on Native people. I mean, you know, I didn't look at all the books in the library, but I looked enough. I really found one book on Indian people, and it was about the Mohawks. And this is a reservation up here in the Northwest. It was about the Mohawks, who were East Coast. And on the cover was a Native man with a tomahawk attacking a white woman. I mean, that was the only book I could find that was on Indian people. I'm going, okay. And then I talked to a bunch of the kids. I talked to a bunch of the parents. I had dinner at people's houses, stayed in people's houses. Just kind of walked around and talked to people. The meantime, the PhD doctor, he'd gone in and was doing the assessment. He was like doing the curriculum, and he was looking at all these different kind of things. And he was doing that kind of official, you know, educator's approach to this. So when they asked for the results, about 3 days we were there, when they asked for the results, they said, well, what'd you find? I said, well, I think the problem is you got no role models for these kids. You got no education that's of interest to them or talks to them. You don't involve the parents in anything here. There's no power. They don't see any people in positions of power or authority here that they can aspire to, you know. They don't have to go to school to become a dishwasher. They don't have to go to school to become, you know, a janitor. They don't have to do any of that, you know. So what's the motivation here? You know, there's no such thing here as a pure education. These folks need jobs. They need an education to be able to better their lives, you know. So I think that's part of it. Also, the counselor, they called the counselor at that time, they called him Mr. Twinkie, because he had a small refrigerator full of Twinkies. And when kids would come, the way he got kids to come and see him to talk about whatever their problems were, was he would give them Twinkies when they came in. So kids would go and make up problems to go and see him to get Twinkies, right? I mean, it's just nuts. The whole thing was nuts. I said, I think that's the problem. The PhD guy comes up, you know, this guy is a full professor, tenured at the University of Arizona at the time. And he comes and says, well, Joseph said pretty much everything I was going to say, except there's a couple of things. One is, in the curriculum, he was more specific as to the curriculum. You know, it was just telling that we could come to the same conclusion, drawing from different data, you know, and different experiences there in the place. And we told him, you need to get people on the school board. And see, the people who were on the school board were all the reason they could be on the school board is because they lived on the reservation, and they lived on the reservation because they were ranchers who were leasing the land, right? And so they, basically, the Native people were all shoved onto one part of the reservation, and the big land-owning people, the people who were making all the money off the land, were white people, all white people, who ran everything, really, essentially, on the reservation. So when you ask about how things come down today, that's an example of how things work, you know, that you have, that the notion of paternalism, the notion of civilizing people in terms of education. See, the idea was not to educate Native people. They didn't care about us being good thinkers. They didn't care about us having good information. They cared about us complying with their standards and comporting to their standards of what they called being civilized. You know, when we were already civilized, when we didn't wholesale slaughter people, for instance, as civilization, when we didn't kill people over religion, for instance, civilization, when we didn't have torture of people because of their thinking, because of the way of their belief systems, you know, none of that took place among Native people. We had commerce in this country before the Europeans came, all across the country. They have found in those mounds for the Native people down in Mississippi and down in the American South, trade goods they had gotten from Native people in the Northwest before the Europeans ever came here. We were trading all that way. People were trading up here in the Northwest all the way down into Mexico. They have found, you know, Northwest Indian trade goods in Mexico and Mexican Indian trade goods up here, all predating the Europeans. So we already had these trade routes. You know, we already had commerce. We already had all these things going on. But there was more acceptance. You know, you, it's your belief system. You live that way, where we encountered each other. I mean, obviously, there were fights anywhere. There's going to be fights when you have territorial issues and you have all that kind of stuff. But there was no genocide. See, I think colonialism is really genocide. It's either physical genocide, cultural genocide, spiritual genocide, emotional genocide, intellectual genocide. It's genocide in all realms. And that still goes on. There's still these attempts to assimilate Native people into the white culture. And that's what the boarding schools intended to do. They wanted to break down the tribal systems, the family systems, the clan systems. They wanted to break down the belief systems. You know, they wanted to break down the language systems, all the customs. You know, because when people went to those kinds of schools, it was completely to erase their nativeness, you know, in every respect.
Karen Salazar explains the Chicano concept of decolonization.
It's extremely important to understand that we are living in a state of neocolonialism, and that's a fact. You know, it's not something that we have to justify. It's a fact. And so, in historically, for people of color, education has served to push that colonial agenda on us and to further ingrain a colonial mentalities. And that's the real brainwashing that happens, right? You know, 500 years ago when they stole our land, you know, they had to use violence. But they knew that they couldn't, you know, continue to use violence generation after generation, you know, to hold on to the land. Sooner or later, they were going to lose it. And so one of the things that they knew that they had to do, you know, and when I say they, I'm talking about, you know, the colonizer, I'm talking about Europeans, I'm talking about those who represent white power and white imperialism. They, you know, they knew that they had to come up with some kind of miseducation project. And we call it miseducation because we know that true education, you know, does the exact opposite. It does, you know, only serves to affirm, you know, humanity. And so what miseducation is about is teaching us lies. It's teaching us, you know, these grand or dominant narratives, you know, telling us stories to make us see things from their perspective to justify why things are the way that they are. You know, everything from, you know, what we learn in our history classes, you know, Columbus discovered America, you know, to the languages that we're taught. You know, we, you know, most of us, you know, in our schools only have English, French, and Spanish, three alien languages to us, while our own languages are, you know, devalued, demeaned, and we don't even know what they're called a lot of times. You know, most young people don't know what Nahua is, don't know Swahili, don't know, you know, haven't even heard these, you know, the names of our own languages. Everything from, you know, our customs, you know, we're very communal people. Indigenous people, African people, we're very communal. We're very much about, you know, loving and, you know, helping and supporting each other. And what's forced on us is very individualistic ideology that forces us to, you know, kind of have that get mine mentality. As long as I get mine, you know, you do you and I do me. And, you know, it serves to, you know, divide and conquer. And so all of that ideology, it comes from school. It starts at school. You know, it serves to dehumanize us. It serves to instill self-hate in us because, again, you know, we always come back to that, you know. Once you love yourself, once you understand who you are, once you love yourself, you will defend yourself against any attack that comes on you. And so they have, you know, they understand that they have to keep us from loving ourselves. They have to keep us from truly knowing who we are. And all of that is part of, you know, a colonial mentality that's pushed on us, that, you know, is forced on us, and without us even really acknowledging that it's happening until, you know, most of us get to college, you know, we don't understand that, you know. So I think that it's important, you know, for educators, you know, to really begin to help students, you know, deconstruct those kinds of processes at a younger age, you know, and that's really the decolonization that we're talking about. You know, we've got to have, you know, mental decolonization before we can start the physical decolonization. You know, we can't have, you know, people, you know, and I'm not sure, you know, people talk about decolonization, you know, there's always like that, you know, kind of divide. Some people think it's just mental other people are about is the physical, you know. Some of us are kind of like, it's both, you know, we need the mental and the physical, you know, because without land, there's no power, there's no people, there's no real community. And so, you know, it's just, it's a process, you know. Miseducation has historically been a project of colonization, and it's up to, you know, us as educators to use true education as a process of decolonization, as affirmation and, you know, an avenue for young people to, you know, begin to redevelop their self-love.
Here, Joseph Quiñones speaks on how colonialism and racism interface.
Here's another thing that I think is real interesting that I've started looking at lately. It's, for me, interesting. It's the notion of how do colonialism and racism, how do they interface? How do they manifest right now here in this place and time? And I think there is different kinds of racism based on the colonial experiences. When we think about racism between blacks and whites, of whites on blacks, let me put it that way rather than between them, of whites on blacks, racism of whites on blacks really has to do with the white notion about blacks as chattel and servants, or slaves and servants. That's the role that, you know, white racists ascribe to black people, that you are either can be owned by us or you serve us, you know. And there's some kind of relationship that evolved out of that way of looking at things. With Native people, when you look at it, we weren't really chattel. They didn't own us. They really didn't enslave us in any kinds of numbers. We were always at war with them. They never were dependent on us in the same way to be served by us as they were dependent on the black people to be served by, you know. And so we were always at war with them. I was never raised up to take care of white people, not historically, not culturally, not in any way. I was never raised up to take care of white people, their feelings, their houses, their beliefs, you know, anything about them. What we were raised up was to fight against them. Native people were raised to fight. They were the enemy. It was clear. They wanted to hurt us. That was clear. Our job was to defend ourselves, protect ourselves, our families, our clans, our tribes. You know, so we were always, in some sense, not interdependent in the way that blacks and whites are interdependent. There's a more symbiotic relationship there because of just the historical perspective. For the people, the so-called Mexicans, they were just completely ignored. I mean, once the land was taken, there was no further business, if you will, to be done. And since they didn't recognize the native Mexicans living there as tribal people, there was no sovereignty issues. There was none of that. See, because with the native tribes of the U.S., there was always the sovereignty stuff that kept those separate and kept those identities working. But with the Mexicans, they just ignored them. The Mexicans who were living in what became the U.S., they just kind of ignored that whole group. And the interesting thing about it, I like to look back at Ken Burns, the documentary he did on the war, World War II, and he documented Native people, he documented black people, he documented Asian people, no Mexican involvement in the war. He didn't document their involvement. No, nothing. He left those out. And that's classic. You know, that's just classic white thinking about various groups. You know, we just ignore that group. Very interesting. And the way it played out in World War II, when you think about it, the black people were kept in segregated, in the beginning of the war, and throughout the war, actually, they were kept in segregated units, officered by white officers. They were in units that were support units, with driving trucks, cooking food, all the servant stuff. Native people were integrated, get this, Native people were integrated into the war units, into the fighting units. We were not kept separate. We weren't kept out. We were actually brought in because they thought of us as warriors. That was the European experience of us, as we'll fight them, you know. Just think of the ramifications of that for how things, what you have access to, how you're protected. You know, why did they put, I mean, aside from the sovereignty and putting us and our issues about sovereignty remaining whole as a people, which they, by the way, remembered at one time, they tried to cancel all the tribes, cancel all the sovereignty, just, you know, and leave us out there in these reservations, actually sell off the land. But they didn't put, I mean, obviously black people got ghettoized in the cities, in the urban areas when they moved up there, but they weren't put on reservations as such, right? Because they had lived together. anytime we were around each other, we were fighting. So they didn't want us around them. They didn't want us in the cities. They didn't want us to be participating in that, because it was just a continuation of that thinking about who are these people? They will kill us if they can, you know? I just think that that kind of consciousness affects the racism that you know, racist white people have against various groups. It's just, it's different, and it's different in its manifestation, and it's different in its ramifications for us. You know, I think it's a good area to study, to look at, because it has implications for social structures. It has implications for how we are going to interact with each other. Has implications for social programming. Has implications for education of white people about culture. Has implications for how we, the various groups, interact with white people in order to help create a more egalitarian society here. Because it's a very different thing to have a symbiotic relationship with somebody and say, we mutually self-identify, and have one where you're separate and being kept separate, like the native people, rather than participating in the way that the Europeans came over. See, assimilation is not possible. Remember, assimilation is when the Europeans came over in the early 1900s, they were the melting pot. That's when the melting pot theory came into play, and the ideas were going to melt all these Europeans and make them into Americans, white Americans. We're going to melt. That was not our experience. That has never been the experience of people of color at all, and certainly not native people. We were never going to melt into that society. It wasn't going to happen. They didn't even make any provisions for it. They were never concerned with that. You know, we were going to be eliminated. The whole idea up until the 40s at least, and the 50s because of when they were terminating the tribes, was to eliminate native people, not to integrate them, to get rid of them, to kill them, whatever way they could, you know, but not to let them join up. You know, it wasn't that avenue. And even when we talked earlier about the schools, the boarding schools, those were not conduits in, you know. You know what they trained the people for there? Servants. They trained them to work in people's houses. They trained them to be bakers. They trained them to clean houses. They trained them to be gardeners. That's the level of education they were aiming us at.
Joseph Quiñones elaborates on his understanding of class structure in America.
Going back to the notion of colonialism, they're concerned about the upset of the class structure, you know, and that the class structure makes Anglos on top. In the U.S., not just white people on top, but in the U.S. it's Anglo people. People of British descent are on top. And then there's a stratification based on different European heritage that goes down from there. They're all saying we're Americans and 27 kinds and Heinz and all that kind of stuff. But really there's a stratification when you talk about money, you know, and that's based on the old European colonial wars, who was fighting who over who was going to colonize what. So that class structure, as it presents itself in the U.S., is based on those fights they had about taking over Africa, taking over America, taking over Central and South America, taking over Asia, you know, and they just stratified it here, institutionalized it here in terms of the class structure, you know. So we're still living with that developed out of the imperial times of Europeans. I just find it interesting that these things can continue for so long, over such a long period of time, you know, and they morph, they change, you know, and they look different, but they still reflect those old European histories.
Damali Ayo is an artist and author of the book How to Rend a Negro, a parody on interactions between black and white people. We discuss touchy subject matter such as white dominance and privilege.
There's a lot of subconscious, I don't know if I'd say reactions or just the ways that people go about their daily life, the way that they present themselves to other people and in communities and just in the world in general, is that, you know, there's this feeling in their, you know, this idea in their subconscious that they have to dominate.
Mm-hmm.
Other people and other cultures.
Mm-hmm. There's a real sense of entitlement. I mean, I think that's what led Columbus here, you know, that the world is the earth for the taking.
Yeah.
And I think that absolutely continues today. I see it everywhere. I see it in children. You know, that really shocks me when I see it, particularly in young white children who just believe that the world is theirs for the taking. Get out of my way. Who are you anyway? You know, and it's I hate. I mean, it's such an intensely racialized subject that it's hard. You know, you're going to get a lot of controversial things being said because of this. But there's something that, you know, I really wonder. You know, is it learned or inherent? But it seems to be passed down generation through generation that, yeah, you know, white folks are entitled to whatever they want.
I know that in some of the work that you've done, you've talked about privilege.
Yeah.
You know, how does that play into this?
You know, white privilege is a fascinating subject. You know, if you can, I'll see if I can hook you up with Tim Wise. He would have some great things to say. He does a lot of work on white privilege. But I actually don't use the word privilege when I talk about whiteness, because I think, particularly when we're dealing with younger people, teenagers and stuff, that groups I'm usually talking to, they understand privilege as something they earn. You know, you get the privilege of using the car if you did all your homework for the week, and it's been misconstrued. And so I think white folks have, they in their head, they really think they earn those privileges that they get. And so I try to talk about it as entitlement, or just break it down, like the notion that you walk out in the world and the world assumes automatically you're smarter, faster, better, brighter than everyone else. That's what it is. And that's not a privilege. That is a complete misconception. So just really trying to lay it out for people that, you know, that's the situation.
Well, and I think, you know, one of the purposes of doing this program is to, you know, I mean, there's a lot of people out there that don't understand that, you know.
Right.
And it's usually those people who have that.
Right.
That,
it's blinding. Yeah. It's blinding.
And so, you know, that privilege is there, but... And people don't want to accept the fact that that's, or admit that it's there, realize that, it's come to terms with that, or even the fact that racism still even exists.
Well, most white people won't even admit that they are white. I mean, that, and when I do my I Can Fix It guide, there's 10 points that my network came up with. We had this guide of 10 points, 5 things white people can do, 5 things people of color can do to help draw an end to racism between people. And the very first step is admit it. Point one, admit it. Just admit that you're white. And I had somebody ask me a question about it the other day, and they're like, do you mean admit that there's racism, or admit that people are different? I'm like, no, admit that you are white. Like, I've seen so many white folks just try to avoid it. They have lots of euphemisms for whiteness. And if you can't admit that, then you can't really place yourself in the context of what is going on in the world, historically, currently, or in the future. You have basically removed yourself from our community when you can't acknowledge where you fit in it. And so it's a very slippery little thing where people start saying, oh, I'm Caucasian, you know, which is just incorrect, you know, because Caucasian encompasses a whole bunch of people, some of whom are brown skin, or, you know, there's a million different names people come up with, or they put their ethnicity forward, Irish, Italian, whatever it could be. And also, you know, when you don't admit that you're white, then you don't own all those white people who have done bad things. You know, it's, you can disassociate yourself from Columbus and Hitler and Jeffrey Dahmer. Like, they're no longer a part of your community. And so there's a lot of reasons I think people want to escape that label, but really admitting it is step one.
Well, how do you feel that you know, they actually take ownership of that ancestry, I mean, privilege is one example of that. I mean, anytime you bring that subject up, people are going to say, well, that, you know, that happened way back when. You know, how am I going to be blamed for that type of thing? Or, you know, how am I supposed to, why should I take responsibility for that?
You know, I feel like if you're going to take responsibility and take ownership and connection to your heroes, then take connection to all of it. So if you want to run around talking about how great Thomas Jefferson was, and although I would debate that seriously, you know, or Benjamin Franklin, who's one of my heroes, you know, then you also need to take responsibility for all the other folks as well. And I find that so fascinating, because white people will constantly, you know, throw out any examples of black folks, Latino folks, Asian folks, as, you know, just in casual conversation. Oh, you're black? Tell me what you think about Michael Jackson and that business, or, you know, it's just silly things that come up, you know. And so there's this kind of, you know, clearly a double standard.
Two elements of colonialism that I see in today's world that are most apparent to me are gentrification and communities dealing with the police from very different perspectives. I continue my conversation with Damali Ayo on these topics.
It's fascinating to me as I sit and I listen to conversations about gentrification, particularly in the Alberta district, in a neighborhood in Portland where I was personally gentrified out of. I was the last Black person to move off my block when our landlord kicked us out in order to, you know, move in and fix up the house. And I remember she walked through my apartment in the house, and she was standing on my yoga mat at some point. And I said something to her, like, one, can you get off my yoga mat? And two, something about gentrification. You know, I'm probably complaining about it. And she didn't even know what the word meant. And that was really a poignant moment for me, you know, that there's this kind of inherent need to just constantly move where the people of color are and push them out. And like, and it just seems to happen for generations and generations. And Columbus is a part of that tradition for sure.
I think as far as the story of Columbus and how it relates to what we deal with today, I think gentrification is one of the most obvious.
It's totally colonization.
Yeah. It's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it is. And then also the police state that a lot of our communities are in.
Oh, my goodness.
You know?
I used to tell people say, well, because I lived on 21st and Wygant, right off of Alberta. And I watched all that happen. Right now, I can't even go back to that neighborhood. I get so upset. And people would say, well, where are they putting all the Black people? Where are they going? And I'd say, well, they're going to Gresham, and they're going to low-income housing, and they are going to jail. And people would look at me like I was crazy. I was like, I've never seen so many police in my neighborhood until the gentrification really started, you know, and they were arresting people very publicly. And I'm not one to get down on police. One of my dearest friends in the world is a police officer. But the whole system, you know, when it comes to they're complicit in it, the neighbors are complicit, the neighbors are calling the cops, the redlining that happens, the contractors, it's all a huge part of that process.
Well, in people of color, you had talked about the community's involvement with that. People of color don't have that same relationship with the police.
Right.
You know, I mean, just across the board, really.
It's amazing. I was at a gentrification listening forum, and all these white folks were talking about how when their neighbor's music is too loud, they call the police. And I'm thinking, my tax dollars are going to this because you can't walk next door and knock on your neighbor's door. That's shocking. It's shocking. And it's totally a cultural thing. That was something I learned. I did not learn that was part of like a white middle class culture to call the police instead of talking to your neighbors. But apparently, and I don't say that this is something I learned, apparently it is.
Well, I always think about, you know, different skits that are done by like Richard Pryor and Chris Rock and everybody. Richard Pryor is talking about, well, you know, people of color are afraid of the police, you know, and they don't want to deal with the police because they got chokeholds that'll kill people, and that's it. You know, sorry, you know.
Yeah.
Whereas Anglos have a different type of relationship with police officers.
Yeah, it's friendlier.
They're the neighbors, you know. Hey, how's it going? They live in their neighborhoods, you know.
Well, they're there to protect them. I mean, there's this, again, it comes from that. When you're living in an entitled state, you are protected by the police. That's part of your entitlement. You know, when you're in a more disenfranchised part of that state, then you're uncomfortable around the police. I'm a fairly benign character, you know, at least like, I'm not a criminal. I might mess with people's minds, but... And I get caught, pulled over by the police. I never know how it's going to go. I really don't know how it's going to go. In fact, there was a time when they had just shot that one guy, I can't remember his name, in his car with a seatbelt on when he was reaching for the glove compartment. And I was so scared because I had my turn signal was out as well. That's what he got pulled over for. So the first thing I did was I went out and I changed the light bulb in my turn signal. And then I made these bumper sticker signs to go in the back of people's cars. It says like, I'm Black and driving. Please don't shoot me. And I drove around with that sign in my car. And I went to Lloyd Mall and passed them out to Black people. I was just so upset and so scared to drive, literally.
Yeah.
So... Yeah, it's a very different experience.
That makes me nervous, you know, living here in Portland. I remember that incident, and that makes me nervous. I think about my experiences as a young, you know, as a teenager growing up and, you know, being with friends of mine where either I was a driver or they were driving and being pulled over for nothing and them saying that our taillight was out or that we didn't have our blinker on or that there was something hanging from the rear view mirror, you know, and just an excuse for them to harass us.
I got followed once in Laurelhurst neighborhood by a cop when I was on my bicycle. I mean, you can't.
Oh, yeah. I've been hit up walking on the street. I've been harassed so many times, I can't even remember how many times I've been harassed.
I believe that.
Yeah. And that's an experience that I don't think most white people can relate to.
No, I mean, thankfully for them, they don't have that experience. I mean, it's a wonderful life in a lot of ways to live without that kind of level of racial tension in your world, you know. And that's, I always used to joke, like, people of color are such multitaskers because we live our lives just like white people do, but yet we have this other level of stuff always going on. This other, okay, when is this going to happen? Or I'm going to, you know, like, it's even something simple. I always joke that I have no life. Like, I don't go out. And because, you know, at the end of a week, somebody calls me up. One of my white friends calls me up maybe and they want to go out. Or even if one of my friends of color, and we're going to go out in public, I never know when that public interaction is going to turn into racial tension. And really, you know, I'd say 7 to 8 times out of 10, it does. Just out of a conversation. Just out of somebody's got their hands up in my hair. Somebody makes a joke or tells me, you know, just they just want to strike up a conversation about who knows what, slavery, reparations, the latest book they read, or the stupidest minstrel movie they saw on, you know, and they want to have that conversation with me, you know.
Well, and it's a trip too, because I think that same exact way, and sometimes I worry because, you know, I want to have intellectual conversations with my friends, and we like to do that.
Yeah.
You know, but there's this fine line that I walk with my white friends, even with my wife, who's white,
mm-hmm.
About any of those conversations, because they view me as somebody who is, oh no, you know, he's going to snap right. on this, you know, or, you know, he's right. Mr. Sensitive, you know.
Right. But and that's so sad because it's not on you. Like, it's on them, because if the world and on the culture, if the world was a better place, that we didn't have to be educating people all the time and being seen as sensitive. We're not sensitive. We're just trying to live our lives. That it gets put on us. For example, one of the things that I'm seeing happen now is people keep saying, will race be an issue for Barack Obama? And you know what? Race is not an issue for him. Race is an issue for everybody else, right? Race is just who he is. He has a race, but the question is, will race be an issue for the country? So, like, we always put that burden, that onus on the people of color, where that is not where it belongs.
Yeah.
How do we as people now move forward under the confines of this current structure of class and racism? How can we heal and rebuild on a conscious level in a way that runs counter to our current colonial situation?
Well, I don't know if I can plug this, but go to fixracism.com, actually, because one of the projects that I'm most excited about that I had the honor of doing over the last few years is, you know, asking this network of 2,000 people, how do we heal? What are the 10 things we need to do? And you can go there and you can download the free document, 17 pages, and it has great explanations of, like, these really simple 5 points for white people and 5 points for people of color, because we need to find a way to do exactly what you did. How do we relate to each other when we are so wounded? Because what usually happens in environments where we try to come together to work through it, even if it's a constructed thing, or even if it's over a drink at the bar, we end up re-wounding usually the people of color. And then the people of color are out of a place of being re-wounded because we had to listen to whether it's white guilt or white people tell us they're racist or white ignorance and underexposure, then we get mad. And then we lash out, and we have every right to do it. It's kind of like if you had a cut on your hand and somebody stuck their finger in it, you would react. You know, you would probably smack them. And so there's this kind of tension, and you feel like saying to somebody, "Didn't you see my freaking cut right there? Like, what are you out of your mind?" And people don't realize that that is what that experience is like. And so this is like a basic. It's like first aid. You know, like, if you see a wound, do not stick your finger in it. You know, that is your basic thing that we have to do. And realize that anybody with brown skin is going to have that wound. They're going to have that experience. It's just reality. And I think that the first thing is people don't want to admit that. Even brown skin people, they don't want to admit that we all have an experience with racism. But talk to anybody for more than 5 minutes and they'll be able to tell you 5 examples. So just being able to say, okay, Like, the first step for white people is admit that you're white. The first step for people of color is just to be real. You know, I think we both have work to do. We have to be ourselves. We have to say there's lots of ways to be black or Latino or Asian. Like, there's lots of ways to just be who we are. And then listening and accepting, you know, listening and hearing and listening and allowing yourself to be listened to, educating ourselves. We don't know enough. Making connections and then taking action. And it's really interesting because at the end of the list, the fifth point for white folks is to take action after you've done 1 through 4, because sometimes people want to jump ahead and then they really mess it up. And then the fifth thing for people of color is to take care, like take care of yourself, because we can burn out. I personally am burnt out.
Well,
like,
we are already wounded.
We are already wounded. Yeah, if we don't heal, if we don't give ourselves space and air and healing salve and all those things that a normal wound would need, it's just going to fester. You know, just like Langston Hughes said. Wasn't it his poem? Let me don't get that wrong. Langston Hughes, A Dream Deferred. So, I think we have to recognize that it is a process of healing. And also, you know, for me, like, I kind of made a big switch in my life from trying to change culture en masse to trying to change individuals. Like, now I do much more, like, health and healing work. I actually just became a personal trainer. I'm doing fitness and stuff. Because I recognize that until people can literally look in the mirror and figure out what they need to change, how can they look at our culture? Like, I always describe racism like a zit on your face, and you're like, oh man, I got a zit, you know? Like, we can't even get to that stage. People are going, oh, it's not there. Like, I can't see it.
They're just covering it with their hair or whatever.
Yeah, they're like, it's not there. They don't
see it, it's not really there.
And it just gets worse if you cover up your hair, because your hair's dirty, right? So, like, you have to actually get in there and you have to pay attention to it. You have to address it. Things don't just go away. And I realized over and over again that until people can self-examine, I've worked with some white people for decades that will just at some point give up. It's just too hard.
I think that's a huge part of American society, is people being introspective.
Yeah, you know, we don't
have it.
Trying
to put ourselves in other people's shoes and just trying to take a look at our own selves.
Admit when you do something wrong. Yeah. Most people can't do that. It's hard, you know, and that's a step. Or admit that you need to change or improve, like, or that there's that you're not perfect. You know, we have spent so much time justifying our existence that we try to make all of our, not just imperfections, but flaws, you know, and issues and difficulties as if they're perfect. And they're not. But if we just want to change them, it's actually a lot easier.
What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun, or fester like a sore and then run? Does it stink like rotten meat, or crust and sugar over like a syrupy sweet? Maybe it just sags like a heavy load, or does it explode?
There's a lot more to be told of the Columbus story. Columbus did make 4 trips total to the Americas. The last 2 trips became more difficult to justify and defend. Increasing opposition mounted toward Columbus in regard to the way things had been handled in the new land. Bartolomé de las Casas, who traveled with Columbus, detailed his opposition to the kind of brutality that was carried out on those islands in literature such as The Devastation of the Indies. Later, massive slave revolts took place on the island of Hispaniola, leading eventually to a period of black independence. Columbus's second arrival outlines a precedence of invasion that was carried out over centuries. I felt that by trip number 2, it would be clear to anyone listening to this program that Columbus's legacy is something to, at the very least, be re-examined. As a person who cares about equality and the rights of every human being, can you still justify the celebration and honoring of this kind of legacy? A legacy of racism, genocide, rape, and plunder, all in the name of conquest. The terms conquest and discovery have been used over the years as soft or nice words that attempt to blanket the realities that exist in this kind of action. Therefore, making it easy for us to turn a blind eye or to ignore current situations that continue this kind of philosophy. Katrina, Gina 6, immigration, child labor, deregulation, the prison industry, our current financial crisis, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. These are only a few examples of how we allow this colonial mindset to continue as a basic premise of our society. I only ask that you take a minute to step back and consider how these things affect our daily lives and interaction with others. I'm Carlos Chavez, and this has been a KBOO Community Radio Public Affairs Special, Colonialism Today and the Impact of Columbus on America. Thank you for listening.